critical mass of people in the United States that will support progressive, even radical politics. And the challenge at this point is for all of those forces, because there's one force, there's the Bernie Sanders movement vis-a-vis the Democratic Party and the establishment and corporate leadership of that party. But within the Bernie Sanders movement itself, there are many tendencies. The question is, are those tendencies going to be able to resolve their contradictions to the point, not eliminate them, but at least modify them to the point that they can hold together and keep this movement going, or are they going to explode?
Larry Hamm, chair of the People's Organization for Progress in New Jersey, and actor Danny Glover speaking with Juan Gonzalez and I last month at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. That does it for the show. I'll be speaking in Seattle Friday night at the Washington State Convention Center. Check our website. Tomorrow's Now produced by Mike Berkner, Mean Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Pan-African Women's Day, Saturday, August 27th at In Other Words Bookstore in Portland. A panel of African women from different organizations will be highlighting the issues impacting African women across the globe, and to highlight the necessity for African women to be united and organized on a worldwide basis against imperialism. Edutainment and childcare will be provided. Again, that's Pan-African Women's Day, Saturday, August 27th at 5:30 p.m. at In Other Words Bookstore, 14 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Rock Against the TPP, Saturday, August 20th at Director Park in Portland. Rock Against the TPP is an effort to educate and fight against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, an anti-democratic deal between 12 countries that was negotiated in complete secrecy by government officials and hundreds of corporate lobbyists. Rock Against the TPP features Downtown Boys, Evangeline Lilly, Danbert Nobacon from Chumbawamba, Makana, Son of None, and many more. Again, that's Rock Against the TPP, Saturday, August 20th at Director Park, 815 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. The concert is all ages and wheelchair accessible, but RSVP is required. More information about how to RSVP, the other performers, and the TPP can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 5:01, time for the KBOO Evening News.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a mysterious internet and cell phone blackout has not silenced activists in Standing Rock, North Dakota, where Lakota and Sioux tribal members continue to block work crews building the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline.
A lawsuit was filed today against the U.S. Forest Service to halt clear-cutting in the most popular part of the Ochoco National Forest.
And the Centers for Disease Control estimates that 25% of Puerto Rico's 3.5 million residents will be infected with the Zika virus by the end of 2016.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, August 17th, 2016. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Lisa Loving. The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project yesterday filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Forest Service to halt a clear-cutting proposal in the most popular part of the Ochoco National Forest. KABU spoke with grassroots activist Karen Coulter about the suit and how it will impact Walton Lake in eastern Oregon.
Let us know. You're at Sacred Stone Camp right now, are you?
No, I am not specifically at the camp. If I was at the camp, I could not be talking to you.
We filed litigation. We are Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, which is part of a project of the League of Wilderness Defenders. And we filed litigation against the Walton Lake timber sale on the Ochoco National Forest because it targets the most popular recreational area on the Ochoco National Forest with heavy logging that would remove quite a lot of the old growth.
We started playing the tape for the second piece.
The whole experience of being there, the whole appearance of the place.
But now we're okay.
For people that are new to this issue, can you describe what is an old growth tree? And in the long term, why is this lawsuit really important for everyone?
You're right. She just
read
my story.
Well, an old growth tree takes centuries
I'm going to read hers now.
To form. In this case, there are
Hold
Douglas
on.
Firs, fir
Wait
trees
a second.
That are up to 60 inches in
that
diameter.
That is one thing I did not even bother to look at. Yes, that's exactly what has happened here.
And they're important both as live structures for wildlife species.
Everything fine now.
Big old
here,
trees.
Let's trade stacks.
For instance, goshawk.
Because you have my stories and I have yours.
Branches of old growth Douglas fir.
That's the one thing we didn't check.
They need large branches.
Sorry, I'll read
what
you're editing.
Roost on, and otherwise they can't survive. And they particularly like Douglas fir because quite often there's mistletoe brooms that actually hide the nest and provide a big platform for the nest. So they're very dependent on that particular tree. Another example is the pileated woodpecker. Once the tree becomes a snag, which is a dead standing tree, or a down log, which is what the snag later becomes. It uses grand fir in particular, grand fir snags and logs to forage on because grand fir decays quite readily and provides habitat for the pileated woodpecker's prey, which is carpenter ants primarily. And so the pileated is very tied to large old growth grand fir and it being allowed to create snags and down logs in the forest for its survival as a species as well as tied to old growth ponderosa pine and other species for nesting holes big enough to accommodate such a large woodpecker. So old growth forest is more than just the live large trees. They also need to be allowed to become snags and down logs for wildlife. And that's a form of carbon storage, which is very important for slowing climate change. And it also provides for soil nutrient cycling when the down logs become part of the soil. We're bringing the suit against the Forest Service who planned the sale. Specifically, it's the Polina Ranger District of the Ochoco National Forest that planned this sale. It's representing, this kind of sale really represents the Forest Service at the behest of private timber corporations aiming for logging of large old growth trees, even though the forest plans in eastern Oregon for the Blue Mountains Forest have a limit of 21 inches in diameter for cutting live old growth trees unless they're hazard trees to the public. And in this case, they're using a categorical exclusion to rush this sale through, realizing that scientifically and publicly, this is a very controversial sale. Old growth forest logging is pretty outdated in terms of our ecological knowledge of the importance of old-growth forests to wildlife and intact ecosystems. And also, this is an incredibly popular recreation area. So they're using what's called a categorical exclusion to rush the whole public process so that they don't have to do real environmental impacts analysis in the form of an environmental impact statement or an environmental assessment. And so the public never has a chance to look at the analysis of the potential environmental impacts before commenting. So they've reduced the public's ability to make informed comments by not informing them with the analysis that would be required in an EA or an EIS, an environmental assessment or environmental impact statement. And beyond that, the categorical exclusion skips the public objection process altogether and forces you to litigate immediately after reading a very skimpy scoping letter that was put out for public comment where there's no discussion at all of the environmental impacts involved. And so this cuts a lot of the public out of the process because most people can't just immediately jump into litigation. We went out and field surveyed this sale on the ground with a volunteer to see what the proposed sale would actually do, and we were very shocked at how much it would transform this area. So we did have a chance to take a look at it before going into litigation.
For now, I need to draw this to a close and ask you, how can people find out more about your work? How can people hook up with you online?
We have a website, which is Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, all spelled out, .org. So that's Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project.org. And on our website, there's a link to profiles of particular timber sales. And there is a link there for the Walton Lake timber sale if people want to find out more about that particular timber sale that we're now litigating. There's actually pictures we took there and more information about things such as the Forest Service using root rot as an excuse to log these big old growth trees when logging actually spreads root rot.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
A mysterious internet and cell phone blackout has occurred at the Sacred Stone Camp in Standing Rock, North Dakota, where Lakota and Sioux tribal members continue to block work crews building out the Dakota Access oil pipeline. LaDonna Brave Bull Allard is the landowner at Sacred Stone Camp, where protesters are massing for direct action. She spoke with KBOO's Chris Andre today about the cell phone and internet blackout at the camp.
Let us know. Are you at Sacred Stone Camp right now? Are you or
No, I am not specifically at the camp. If I was at the camp, I could not be talking.
I was going to say we can't. We wouldn't.
They blocked all the cell phones and they blocked all outgoing communication. So right now, Sacred Stone Camp is in a blackout, and so nobody can communicate. So we have to leave the camp in order to talk on cell phones, upload videos, or anything else.
Well, was this a decision on the part of the camp?
No, it is Dakota Access and the American government.
That's right. Who gave them the authority to shut down communications?
We don't know.
When did that happen?
Yesterday.
So I believe, as I understand it, there was a meeting, a council meeting at the camp yesterday, and many people were occupied at that meeting. So they took the opportunity to shut everything down. That's what it sounds like happened.
Well, no. They started. Dakota Access started sending drones. They have drones all over above. And every time the drones went along, we lost signal. We couldn't use our phones. And then now they have a plane that continually goes in a circle above us to block all cell phone. And now they've upped it. So now they've cut out all cell phone reception in the area.
That's pretty stunning. So other news media outlets, in addition to KBOO, have been trying to get through it and can't. Are we the only one that's doing this, or how are you getting information out to?
So we do have different media on the ground. We know we have HBO Vice on the ground. We have other media crews that are on the ground, but they shoot, but they have to leave the grounds in order to upload any of their things. And so people are shooting videos and then leaving the campsite to upload their videos and their information. So it comes like an hour or two later, maybe 4 hours later than when the incident happened.
Well, who would you appeal to have this stopped?
So right now, I believe our chairman is in a meeting with Senator Hovind and Senator Heitkamp. In Bismarck, I know that people are calling the governor of North Dakota, and we have people that are trying their best to to listen to us.
It sounds very stressful. I really appreciate the fact that you are taking time to talk with us. So what war zone.
Yeah, I will say on our part, it's a defender zone. On our part, it's a prayer zone. We have to protect the water. And now we're 5,000 strong and people are coming from everywhere. It's kind of overwhelming to think, oh my God, look at all these amazing Native people that are coming together and standing the ground. But not only that, they're coming together and singing songs and dancing together and laughing together. It is something I never thought I would see in my lifetime, the coming together of the nations.
That is incredible. Tell us more about that, can you?
So we have all kinds of tribes there. We have Onondaga. We have the Mohawks. We have, of course, Oshete Shakoan, Lakota, Dakota, Nakota people, Poncas, Omahas, the Blackfeet. I mean, we have so many tribes there, the Apache, the Diné. And everybody keeps calling and calling and sending. They're sending buses and more troops and people on the ground. And it's like we're able to sit and talk with each other and form allies and alliances again. It's like the rebirth of a nation.
That was LaDonna Brave Bull Allard speaking with KBOO's Chris Andre this morning at Air Cascadia. Find out more about the protest on their Facebook page, which is called No Dakota Access in Treaty Territory, Camp of the Sacred Stones. Once again, that's No Dakota Access in Treaty Territory, Camp of the Sacred Stones on Facebook. The Centers for Disease Control estimate that a full 25% of Puerto Rico's 3.5 million residents will be infected with the Zika virus by the end of 2016. The U.S. government recently declared a public health emergency in Puerto Rico as a result of the Zika epidemic there. With this declaration, federal officials will be able to provide additional support to the Puerto Rican government, including funds for vector control and outreach and education efforts. The declaration came after 1,914 new Zika cases were reported in the previous week, compared to a total of 1,650 cases reported in the continental U.S. since December. Puerto Rico has reported a total of 10,690 cases. The decision to increase aid comes after a bill proposing more than $1 billion to combat Zika died on the U.S. Senate floor in June. According to the Centers for Disease Control, about 40 million Americans travel each year to countries in South and Central America, as well as the Caribbean, where Zika has been detected.
The federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled unanimously yesterday that the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment contained in a congressional bill does in fact prohibit the U.S. Justice Department from shutting down medical marijuana businesses that are in compliance with state law. KBOO's Ray Bodwell talked today with Bill Ponzer, an attorney in California specializing in marijuana law, who's been a longtime advocate for marijuana legalization.
Bill, thanks for joining us. Perhaps you could start out by just telling the listeners what the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment really is.
Basically, it was a rider to the yearly budget that said that the Department of Justice could not spend any money to interfere with state medical marijuana laws. States in the United States, along with, I believe, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the District of Columbia, that had passed medical marijuana laws, that the Department of Justice could not spend any money to interfere with those laws.
And what impact will the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling actually have?
The Department of Justice interpreted it to mean we can't sue California, we can't sue Oregon, we can't sue Washington, we can't sue them to make them change their laws, but an individual patient who's growing their own medicine or someone who's growing for a collective or cooperative or otherwise legally under state law, we can still go after the individual. So that was the issue before the court. The Ninth Circuit agreed with the defendants and said that when you are prosecuting the individuals who are acting under the state law, you're interfering with the state law.
The amendment is very specific to medical marijuana. Is there any likelihood that this will cross over into recreational sales as well?
Well, the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment does not address non-medical cannabis at all. Adult use is not included in it. In the future, I mean, I think eventually, you know, we're going to see cannabis taken out of the Controlled Substances Act. It will be legal at some point.
Bill, last week the DEA refused to remove marijuana as a Schedule I drug. These are drugs that are typically determined to have no medical use and high potential for abuse. Yet over 20 states currently recognize medical marijuana. What do you think this means?
I mean, they're just holding on to this ridiculous notion that cannabis is Schedule I. Now, Schedule I means that it is no accepted medical use. When over half of the states have already said it has medical use, the doctors say it is medical use, the scientists say it is medical use, the nurses say it is medical use, the patients say it is medical use. But DEA interprets no accepted medical uses, but they define abuse as use. Anybody using cannabis is abusing it. Some, as far as DEA is concerned, if a cancer patient is throwing up so much that they can't do the chemo and the cannabis allows them to do their chemo, DEA considers that abuse. Every year in America, between 1,100 and 1,500 people die from aspirin poisoning. No one has ever died from cannabis poisoning. It's, as the DEA's own administrative law judge, Francis Young, found, it is one of the safest substances known to man. Well, I just think that, you know, someday in the future, probably long after I'm gone, but maybe in my son's lifetime, I think that people are going to look back at the whole war on drugs same way that we look today, look back on slavery or women's suffrage. You know, the idea that people could be slaves or that women couldn't vote seems so archaic and so wrong, and we can't imagine how that could ever have been. I think the war on drugs historically will wind up in the same place.
Bill, we thank you so much for your time. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
After the expansion of health insurance coverage following implementation of the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, people who gained health coverage increased their use of prescription drugs, but their out-of-pocket spending for medicine dropped significantly. In its new report, RAND found that among those who got private insurance as a result of the ACA, there was a nearly 30% increase in prescriptions filled. Out-of-pocket spending for prescriptions for that group fell by 29% compared with the previous year. Researchers from the RAND Corporation studied data from nearly 7 million prescription drug users nationally. Even bigger changes were reported among people who received Medicaid coverage through the expansion of that program through the ACA. That group saw a nearly 80% increase in prescription use, and at the same time, a nearly 60% drop in out-of-pocket spending. The Affordable Care Act is also nicknamed Obamacare.
After 15 years in business, Portland's iconic karaoke bar, The Boiler Room, will be shut down from its Old Town location next month. A San Francisco-based investment firm, Swift Real Estate Partners, has purchased the building. Swift has purchased a half dozen buildings in Old Town in the last year and a half, including whole blocks along Northwest Cooch and Davis and three quarters of a city block at Southwest First and Ash. The Boiler Room's last night will be September 20th. It's not yet known who the new tenants will be.
Portland's houseless situation can seem like a mix of Not in My Front Yard and Whack-A-Mole, according to KBOO News poet Dan Raphael.
Camping out. It's not just for weekends anymore. When the campers' tents showed up in Lentz, the police had little to say. But as soon as the first camped around Laurelhurst, the police showed up that same day. Sweep the homeless from Springwater Corridor when none of the shelters can hold anymore. Does anyone expect them to just go away? Portland rents are so high and in such short supply, finding shelter's a difficult play. People camping on the streets is a symptom of deeper ills. Low pay, high prices, impossible interest on credit card bills, too many people in too little space, increasing bleak challenges for the entire human race. Besides much more funding, we need better zoning, more creative ideas for more flexible housing, more community interest, less land speculation. The whole city benefits when we improve this situation. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael. Be thankful for what you have. Share whatever you can.
A gentrifying Northeast Portland neighborhood managed to save an historic mansion from demolition this week. Okabok Mansion, built in 1913, was going to be demolished and replaced by several housing units. When they heard the news, people living near the mansion came together to stop the historic landmark from being destroyed. Many neighbors put their finances on the line to raise $1.1 million to buy the mansion. The place was rumored to have hosted Martin Luther King Jr. during a reception in the 1950s, but more recently it housed the Alfred Yahn Home and a series of youth shelters that were shut down by the state, by Multnomah County. For many years, this home was known as the Alfred Yahn House. The house was flipped earlier this year and triggered a scandal after Multnomah County sold it at auction. It will undergo another $500,000 in renovations, and its future use is still being discussed.
A new study shows younger immigrant workers are helping to replace Oregon's aging workforce. Foreign-born workers are also providing billions of dollars for the state's economy through taxes and consumption. KBOO's Leila Yao reports in cooperation with the Oregon News Service.
Immigrants play a vital role in Oregon's economy, according to a new study. The Partnership for a New American Economy says 10% of Oregon's population was born abroad, but makes up 13% of the state's workers. Jeremy Robbins, who heads the Partnership for a New American Economy, says the immigrant workforce, nearly three-quarters of which is working age, is helping to support and replace Oregon's rapidly aging native-born population, only half of which is working age.
When you think about who's going to support Social Security, who's going to care for seniors, who's going to replace the workers that are leaving, that's hugely important.
The study estimates 3% of Oregon's population is made up of undocumented immigrants. Across the country, it's estimated more than 85% of the undocumented population is working. Robbins adds that immigrants are paying taxes. Foreign-born Oregon residents earned nearly $10 billion and paid more than $2 billion in local, state, and federal taxes in 2014.
That is a huge boon for the fiscal health of the state. It's also a huge boon through their consumption and the money that they're pouring into the economy that are creating jobs.
Immigrant workers prop up Oregon's agricultural sector in a big way, the study notes. In 2014, 40% of farm workers were born in another country, and 28% were undocumented. The industry contributes just over $4 billion to Oregon's GDP annually. Robbins says the low-skilled immigrant workforce is doing the work highly educated, native-born Oregonians aren't willing to do. In his view, immigration reform could help workers all around.
If you want to have a system that is sustainable, you don't want to have a system that depends on undocumented labor. You want a system that has actual legal ways to get the workers that we are hiring anyway and that we need, and I think that is better for everyone involved.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegadoff.
Uncertainty and skepticism continue to surround the proposal to build a 400-bed homeless shelter in Industrial Northwest, which would be the largest shelter in Portland if it were built. Portland attorney John DiLorenzo has stepped forward, threatening to sue the city over their agreement to lease the property from the Bureau of Environmental Services for $10,000 a month, which DiLorenzo says is only 10% of the market rate. By underpaying the Bureau of Environmental Services for their property, DiLorenzo argues the project will be indirectly subsidized by taxpayers' sewer fees. The proposal was originally brought to the city council by Portland developer Homer Williams, promising significant funding from the private sector. City Council approved the plan in a 3-2 vote on August 10th, but most of the details are still undefined, especially regarding long-term operating costs and organization. It's not clear who or what organization would manage the shelter. KBOO reporter Teresa Mitchell was at the City Council today when the council discussed the Terminal 1 proposal and police accountability issues.
The Portland City Council met this morning, approving multi-million dollar spending projects, often in rapid succession. All items passed with a unanimous vote, with the exception of developer Homer Williams' Oregon Trail of Hope homeless warehousing project, which was opposed by Commissioner Amanda Fritz.
I believe this is a waste of taxpayers' money. I believe that the Terminal 1 as a mass shelter, if it was going to be developed that way, should be developed or looked into with private money, as we were promised last week. And presumably, we were planning to apply to Metro for something else before the Terminal 1 discussion started, I think, barely 2 or 3 weeks ago. So I can't in good conscience support this application now.
Individuals for Justice police watchdog Jill Walsh reacted to money appropriated for the study of police response to mental health issues, saying it was unlikely to be effective.
That's 10 years ago. I was put through the whole process, taken down to the Justice Department, fingerprinted, photographed. Recently, about a month ago, I was arrested again, here in City Council. And of course, you know by now, they dropped all the charges because it was a false arrest. Nothing's changed in 10 years. Nothing. Nothing has changed. We've spent millions of dollars and nothing has changed. When I was arrested a few weeks ago, it was the same as 10 years ago. The police were jerks.
For KBOO Radio News, I'm Teresa Mitchell.
Portland officials released a proposal today that could require building owners to reinforce buildings at risk of crumbling during an earthquake. Though no exact time limit has been proposed, seismic improvements would be required for brick buildings with no steel reinforcements during the next 10 to 25 years. More critical buildings, such as hospitals, power generation buildings, and police stations, will be required to make reinforcements during the next 10 years. Schools and churches without steel reinforcements will need to add them within 20 years, while offices, apartments, and other unsafe buildings will need to make improvements within the next 25 years. Two public forums will be held in September on the proposal. Officials hope the City Council will approve it by May of next year.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for News from the Boo at 5:45, followed by Making Contact at 6, and then Free Culture Radio with Doug McVeigh. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny and hot, highs near 96. Winds out of the northwest will breeze by at 6 to 11 miles per hour. Thursday night will be clear with lows around 65. Today in history, the grooviest event in music history, the Woodstock Music Festival, drew to a close after 3 days of peace, love, and rock and roll on Max Yazger's dairy farm in Bethel, New York. The quote of the day is from the Dalai Lama. In order to carry a positive action, we must develop here a positive vision.
In a bizarre twist, it appears that the National Security Agency has itself been hacked. A group identified as the Shadow Brokers claims to have stolen code from a team tied to the NSA. They've posted examples of that code on certain websites. Outside experts have said that they appear to be genuine examples of an outdated code used in the production of NSA malware. That malware may have been used to infect the computer systems of countries such as Russia, China, and Iran. The Shadow Brokers posted teaser samples on a website and promised much better information to the highest bidder. They put the opening bid at 1 million bitcoins, or approximately $500 million. So far, the bidding has come in at less than $1,000.
A congressional investigation is underway regarding doctored intelligence reports emanating from the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, about the so-called Islamic State, or ISIS. A preliminary report says that in late 2014 and the first half of 2015, military leaders at CENTCOM minimized the threat posed by ISIS, contradicting information gleaned by career intelligence analysts. Free Speech Radio News' Nell Abram speaks with Tampa Bay Times military reporter Howard Altman about that report and its implications for the credibility of the information that informed U.S. military action in the region.
Late last week, a joint congressional task force issued a blistering report saying high-level intelligence officials in the U.S. military doctored reports about the battle against the so-called Islamic State, or ISIS, making it appear more successful than it actually was. The congressional probe began in late 2015 after a whistleblower reported concerns about intelligence handling at U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, based at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida. Howard Altman is a journalist with the Tampa Bay Times who specializes in the U.S. military and veterans affairs. He joins us to talk about the report. Howard, welcome to FSRN.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
First, let's start at the beginning. The congressional probe began last December after a whistleblower came forward with concerns. Who was in charge of CENTCOM at the time, and what were the allegations?
Well, at the time that the allegations take place, it was Army General Lloyd Austin III was in charge. And the allegations are that intelligence reports that were developed in CENTCOM's intelligence directorate were manipulated to make it seem that the efforts to train Iraqi security forces were going better than the reality was, and also that Islamic State, the strength of that organization, was less than the reality was. They're troubling allegations, obviously, because you never want to have intelligence manipulated for any particular reason. It needs to, you know, be pure in terms of what's going on.
What does the preliminary report find?
Several things. One, that there's a toxic atmosphere in the Joint Intelligence Center at CENTCOM, which is where this information is taken in and developed and presented up the chain, that there were concerns that the information was being sweetened to make it look like that it was better than that the situation was better than it really was. And really what's most, there's two things to me that really jump out that is most concerning, is that there's an annual survey conducted of attitudes and process and objectivity in the intelligence community. And of 125 analysts and managers that responded, over 50% of the analysts responded that CENTCOM's procedures, practices, and processes hampered objective analysis. And 40% said that they experienced an attempt to distort or suppress intelligence in the past year. And then there were comments that were included, and 32 of the 71 people said that they made direct allegations of distortion of intelligence to fit a positive narrative. And that's really concerning. And the other thing that jumps out is that the leaders of CENTCOM and the intelligence community didn't react to this. The whistleblower came forward in May of 2015. The results of this survey were presented to CENTCOM leadership in December of 15. And so there's a concern that, to the intelligence experts I talked to, that these situations weren't dealt with earlier.
Howard Altman with the Tampa Bay Times. Let's place this in context. The probe begins just about the same time that the self-styled Islamic State quickly took control of three Iraqi cities, Ramadi, Mosul, and Tikrit. Just weeks later, the U.S. began airstrikes. CENTCOM is the military epicenter of this now two-year massive bombing campaign that's involved thousands of U.S. troops and killed an unknown number of civilians. In fact, one independent monitoring group, Air Wars, says at least 1,500 non-combatants have died in Iraq and Syria, and that number could be much higher. Is it fair to say that the U.S. decision to begin military action against ISIS in Iraq when it did, and the pace at which it's pursued the battle, was informed by doctored intelligence analyses?
It's hard to say, to be honest. They're looking at what took place in really starting in late 13, early 14. You know, Islamic State rose up in Syria in 2013, and then by June of 2014, it's taken over Mosul and other cities in Iraq, as well as Raqqa, which is its putative capital. You know, clearly there were indications from some people in the intelligence community that reported that this is a concerning organization that should be taken seriously. I had one Iraqi general tell me that he had been in Tampa in the spring of 2014 and was warning people this organization is something to be taken seriously. Whether this is a result of doctored intelligence, you know, I don't think that the report really knows that yet. My read of the report is that it may have. I don't know that it's clear that it definitely did. And there's certainly greater levels of investigation that have to take place here.
So where does this probe go from here?
Well, the House panel is continuing to investigate. And by the way, the Democrats on the House, it came up with a different finding. And they looked and they saw problems, but they didn't believe it was politicized. So this investigation is continuing. And then there's one that is going on with the Department of Defense Office of Inspector General, which is looking into this as well. My hope would be that they really do take a greater look at some of the processes and procedures, some of the specific reports that are claimed to be doctored, and interview those people who are in charge at the time and get their take on why this was done. None of this is in the House report, nor is there any explanation of why this would have been done, nor is there any direct link to the White House.
Finally, there's been a change of command at CENTCOM since the period under which is under review. Is there any indication whether any of these systems or procedures or cooperation levels between intelligence agencies has changed since that chain of command?
Well, the report says that things have improved since Joe Votel took over in March 31st of this year. Votel clearly knows the command. He was, before he became the CENTCOM commander, he was at the SOCOM, U.S. Special Operations Command, also at MacDill Air Force Base, and he was neighbors with General Austin. He was read into what was going on, so he clearly, you know, had a understanding of the issues even before he got there.
Howard Altman is with the Tampa Bay Times. He is a journalist covering U.S. military and veterans affairs. Howard, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
15 inmates from the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay were transferred to the United Arab Emirates earlier this week. It's being hailed as the largest single transfer of Guantanamo detainees by the Obama administration so far. FSRN's Jacob Resnick has more.
U.S. officials confirmed late that 12 Yemeni and 3 Afghan citizens were resettled to the United Arab Emirates. The move brings the total number of detainees down to 61 at the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. That's a stark contrast to the 779 detainees when Obama took office in 2009. The president campaigned on a pledge to close the controversial facility in his first term, but ran up against political opposition from Republican and Democratic lawmakers who passed laws barring transfers to the U.S. mainland. Most of the detainees have been held for more than a decade without charge or trial. The Pentagon's reliance on questionable legal reasoning to deny the men due process has been criticized by rights groups around the globe.
We're thrilled with this news. We're very happy to see 15 individuals leave Guantanamo and be transferred elsewhere.
That's Elizabeth Beavers, a policy coordinator for security with human rights at Amnesty International in Washington.
It's a very strong step in the right direction, and it's a signal from the Obama administration that they're willing to take the difficult political steps necessary to move forward on closing Guantanamo before the end of their administration.
Republicans reacted to the news with dismay. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida called the transfer reckless, and presidential candidate Donald Trump told the Miami Herald last week that he'd be in favor of keeping the military detention center open indefinitely in order to try U.S. citizens accused of terrorism in military tribunals rather than criminal courts.
It's going to be
perfect. Jacob Resnick, FSRN.
This weekend, more than 100,000 people will gather in Seattle to demonstrate for federal marijuana legalization and an end to the drug war. Seattle's Hemp Fest celebrates its 25th anniversary this year. KABU reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Vivian McPeak, the executive director of Seattle Hemp Fest.
My name is Vivian McPeak, and I'm the executive director of the world's largest annual cannabis policy reform event, the Seattle Hemp Fest.
Vivian, this year Seattle Hemp Fest will be August 19th, 20th, and 21st up in Seattle, 3 full days. Could you tell us, a little bit about what you have planned?
Yeah, this is our 25th anniversary, and we are going to basically have 120 bands and 120 speakers on 6 stages on a mile and a half of beautiful waterfront park downtown Seattle. And we're going to have 400 arts, craft, food, and informational vendors. And we're going to have 1,000 volunteer staff of 118 crews working to make it happen. We're going to spend the next 4 days building Hemp Fest and erecting everything. And then we'll spend 3 days raging against the drug war. And then we have 3 days to tear it down, clean it up, haul it out, and return the parks back to their pristine condition.
It is a massive effort. It's a massive effort. How many people, what's a rough estimate of how many folks will be coming through the park?
Well, you know, the last couple of years, we worked with the city of Seattle to hire people to count heads coming in and going. And as far as I'm not completely satisfied that they're able to keep up with everything, they counted about 110,000 last 2 years ago and about 106,000 last year. So it must be something close to that.
Now, is that per day, or is that for the whole thing?
Oh, that's for the whole thing.
For the whole thing, wow.
I'm not confident that they can absolutely catch everybody coming in. They're coming in at such a tremendous volume, but there's at least 100,000 people coming through.
Talk to me for a moment about the Rick Smith Symposium.
Yeah, the Rick Smith Symposium is a 40 by 100 foot kind of circus tent type structure where we have a stage inside and we have panel discussions all 3 days taking place. We also have the coveted VIP party Friday night that takes place in there for our VIP members and all the kind of cannabis luminaries who show up. And it's a really special thing where, sometimes we have keynote speakers, sometimes we have product sampling, that kind of stuff. And in a way, it's a little bit of the heart and soul of HempFest.
I've got to ask the question because, people are asking, if it's legal, why are you bothering?
Not only, of course, do we have a lot of goals and a lot of work to do, but while we're having this conversation, somebody in America, many people in America, I think one every 19 seconds is going to be arrested for cannabis and their life is going to change and they may lose their job or their reputation or their money or their freedom or their children, all kinds of things. But there's something else too. I mean, not only do we have a lot of work to do and just because you can have a half ounce in each pocket and walk down the street in Seattle, and just because our drug dogs don't smell for pot anymore, no reason to give up. But, in Germany, every year they have this thing called Oktoberfest. And as many as a million people celebrate the culture of beer. And I'm not sure that beer has ever been illegal in Germany. So we don't see any reason why, if cannabis was completely legal, that there wouldn't be a reason to have a huge cultural celebration of all things cannabis.
Well, Seattle Hemp Fest, it started out, you didn't start out with 100,000 people passing through and hundreds of bands and all that. It grew. So, As it's grown in size, at what point? When do you think Seattle Hemp Fest became a truly national event?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I know when we became an international event, and that's when the police handed out Doritos at our event instead of arresting people in 2000 and